welcome to this joint session of the Early Modern Seminar and Renaissance Seminar. I can see some people from both sides, which is good. I'll speak today with Catherine Cavesi, who is a lecturer at the University of Melbourne in Renaissance Italian History. She studied and studied the postdoc, I think, at Oxford, and then worked in Western Australia at Notre Dame University, if I'm right, and then has been at the University of Melbourne for some time. And has published several books, including one on sumptuary law and Renaissance Italy. And she's speaking to us today about luxury and the ethics of greed in Renaissance Italy. So, let's take it away.
Thanks, Rosa. I have for several years now been engaged on a research project exploring luxury and the ethics of greed in Renaissance Italy, and in recent years it's been fabulous having Rosa coming on board as part of the project as well. What I'd like to do today for the first half is to outline the project itself and its broader trajectories, and then spend the second half focusing on two treatises from 16th century Milan, which are of particular significance, I think, for tracing the development of attitudes to luxury and its gradual legitimisation over the period under scrutiny. It probably goes without saying that excessive consumption and the ethics of greed are burning topics in contemporary society, denounced, amongst others, by Barack Obama in the first week of his presidency, and also by my former Prime Minister, Kevin Rudd, in the first year of his prime ministership as well. Indeed, a key feature of contemporary Western culture is a ceaseless, complex and ambivalent discourse about materialism, consumption and luxury. These discourses, however, have a long history. Indeed, in modern times, the phenomenon of luxury and the ethical dilemmas it raised, I would argue, first appeared in Renaissance Italy, although I'd be delighted to find some earlier examples if any of you know of them. In this period and place, for the first time in Europe since antiquity, luxury emerged as a core idea in the conceptualization of consumption. Simultaneously, greed, manifested in new, unrestrained consumption practices, came under close ethical scrutiny. By foregrounding the impact of the new luxury on this society's self-conception at all social levels, one can begin to unravel the complex interaction of competing paradigms at the origins of modern consumption practices, paradigms that continue to inform Western culture to the present day. The aim of our project is to provide the first comprehensive analysis of the discourses, both visual and textual, engendered by the availability of new luxury goods in Renaissance Italy. And we hope it will thereby break new ground in studying the impact and dissemination of these goods, not only through elite writings and images, but also, thanks to Rosa's involvement, through popular culture at all levels. The aim is thus to revise, broaden and deepen our understandings of the impact of and origin of the consumption of non-essential goods as one of the defining characteristics of Western capitalist society and of modernity. So a core strand of this project is to investigate the profound cultural impacts of luxury on a society in which, for the first time, those who were not members of the elite began to consume conspicuously. Popular and scholarly views of the Renaissance are that it was an age of luxury, yet no one has really analysed what this might have meant for people in the period itself, or even whether the word luxury had any currency. As a result, unfortunate confusions, assumptions, and even mistranslations of core concepts have resulted in an incomplete and at times incoherent picture. In particular, there is a remarkable degree of slippage between the use of luxury and of magnificence in current discourse that seeks to explain the use and display of wealth in the period. An essay of mine currently in press seeks to clarify the important differences between magnificence and luxury. It argues that luxury became a key means of describing in negative terms an emerging social class, and I'd like to spend a little time now summarising that article as it's key to understanding the significance of the treatises that I'll be looking at in a moment. It's frequently been assumed that consumption of luxuries was the preserve of elites. To describe their expenditure as luxurious would, however, have bewildered and certainly insulted elite Renaissance consumers. Elites had, of course, always had access to wealth and what it could buy, but rather than luxury, as we understand it, display of their wealth was styled as the virtue of magnificencia, magnificence. Magnificence was seen as befitting those of elite station. It was even expected of them. This group transformed what might in another context be seen as mere luxury into the civic virtue of magnificence, which had an illustrious classical and Christian pedigree. Those engaged in the practices of magnificencia were the conspicuous minority of Renaissance consumers, but their conspicuousness has meant that they have been the focus of constant attention, and I don't intend to replicate the arguments of the numerous studies on the magnificent in the Renaissance here. There were, however, and of course, deeper resonances to consumer culture in Italy. This culture involved a network of participants from textile workers, tanners, dyers, middlemen, artisanal craftsmen, merchant traders, and so on. It was the percolation of consumer culture through the many layers of Renaissance society that makes it such a fascinating subject for those interested in the many facets of the consumer economy. With the expansion of trade and the growth in personal wealth, however, for the first time the wider populace had access to goods normally reserved for elites. Anyone with money could buy the new goods. So elites now had to confront a populace able to imitate their lifestyles. Their response was a sharp condemnation of such novel display, which they viewed as improper, immoral, and often illegal. It was in this context that they re-envisioned an ancient concept, that of luxuria, and coined a new word in the vernacular, lusso, or luxury, coined by elites precisely to distinguish such base consumption from traditional magnificence. Our project analyses the ways that understandings of this new phenomenon of luxury evolved as the culture confronted it. Much of the now extensive research on consumption, which has emerged in the last quarter century, and a lot of it going on here at Warwick, has focused on the advent of mass consumption, its accompanying manifestations in 19th century Britain, France and America, and its consequences for understandings of 20th century Western society and present-day global consumerism. A major part of the scholarly dialogue has been an ongoing debate about the birthplace of consumer society. And whilst 18th century Britain and 17th century Holland, each with good reasons, have their champions, Richard Goldthwaite, I think, has convincingly and compellingly placed the origins of consumer society in Renaissance Italy and continues to produce illuminating research on the economy of Renaissance Florence in particular. And the themes of luxury and greed, which I'm interested in, really emerge out of the rich corpus of work stimulated by Goldthwaite's arguments on the preconditions for luxury in Renaissance Italy. Most of this research in the Italian Renaissance context is concentrated on detailed empirical studies of what was being consumed and how. And Warwick, again, of course, has a distinguished record in this respect. But also Thornton's study of Italian interiors, Welch's study of shopping, the research of those involved with the Material Renaissance Project, the exhibition and publications from the project on the home in Renaissance Italy, are excellent examples of this new research in material culture. This project, though, has a different focus in that I'm not concerned so much with what was being consumed as with the underlying cultural shifts necessary for the acceptance of more widespread consumption in the first place. The only aspect of Italian consumption practices to receive this kind of conceptual treatment has been this concept of magnificence, which, as I've just outlined, though quite distinct from luxury, has often been mistaken for it. Fraser Jenkins' examination of a theory of magnificence which developed under Cosimo de' Medici has underpinned a series of studies of the 15th century artistic and architectural manifestations of magnificence, of other humanist defences of magnificence, of early instances of the theory, and even with Peter Howard's recent work of the preaching of magnificence. The contemporary apologia for magnificence centred on the uses of expenditure and patronage to promote and secure societal elites, political structures, and worship of the divine. So, as I said earlier, what might be seen as mere luxury by others was by these associations transformed into this virtue of magnificence. Luxury, in classical Latin luxor, luxuria, on the other hand, had no such associations or pedigree. Yes, good. To the ancient Romans, luxuria was magnificentia's bastard child. It was associated amongst the ancients not with elites at their benevolent best, but with elites in decline and newly rich on the rise. Luxuria or luxuries was a derived form of luxor, And the Romans used these words interchangeably in many contexts to mean extravagance, profusion, luxury, riotous living, and excess. The Romans made a clear distinction between excess in private uses of wealth, which they denigrated as luxuria, and public uses of wealth for the greater good, which was splendor and magnificencia. According to John Sikora's pioneering study on luxury, luxuria was seen as a transgression against reason and a subversion of the natural order, which, according to Cato, amongst others, would bring ruin to individuals and thereby to whole societies, states, and civilizations. By the early Middle Ages in Europe, when very few enjoyed much wealth, luxuria had become further degraded. In dictionaries of medieval Latin, luxor no longer appears, and whilst luxuria does, it is without its broader classical meaning of all those definitions that I gave you earlier of excess and extravagance. And in the Middle Ages, it's only used in the sense of lust and dissipation. Luxuria, in other words, by the Middle Ages, was used exclusively to mean excessive bodily appetites, and in particular, lust. As the word for one of the seven deadly sins, luxuria embarked on its long career of ignominy in Church Latin. Luxury, as we now understand it, and as the Romans originally conceived it, as idea, word, and practice, simply ceased to be. And no one, anywhere in Europe, up to at least 1400 and beyond, understood the word luxuria and its various vernacular equivalents in any sense other than lust, although it's remarkable how often people mistranslate luxuria as luxury when they see it. Even the Princeton Index of Christian Art, I was a bit appalled to find out. When the aping classes, with their new practices of consumption, started to make their presence felt from the late 13th century, legislators, theologians, and writers did not, therefore, have an available vocabulary to describe such practices. One of the best sources to search for what words were used is sumptuary laws, of which more than 300 were enacted in the period 1250 to 1500, both in Latin and in the vernacular, so they're really good for seeing what words are used in both. Explanatory preambles to sumptuary laws reveal a range of ambivalent attitudes to the new goods and practices in the period, but the words luxuria and lusso are completely absent from sumptuary laws. The Italians legislated variously against pompa, sumptus, vanitas, le spese inutili, vana ambizione, and costoso ornamento, but not against lusso or luxuria. I haven't found a single one that mentions those words. Another source is sermons on the topic of expenditure, and in this case there's more slippage. Luxuria, in its sense of lust, is employed by many of the celebrity preachers to link expense and ornamentation, especially in clothing, to excessive bodily appetites and to the generation of lustful desire. So I've just given one example among many here, many that one could find, the Franciscan Orfeo de Cancellari, who views costly clothing, false hair and makeup as evidence of personal vanity, which he then argues could lead to the ruin of others through lustful provocation. So there's that link there between excess in clothing and the generation of lust. But throughout the 13th, 14th and 15th centuries, what we would call luxury goods were not referred to once, as far as I can see, by Italian legislators, preachers or chroniclers. Instead, expenditure on ornaments and clothing was linked with luxuria or lust, but not luxury goods. In the mid-15th century, the conjuncture of new wealth and new consumptive practices finally stimulated a Florentine humanist sufficiently to inspire him to create a vernacular term for luxury, the word lusso. As I have discovered, lusso is first used in 1441 by the Florentine priest, humanist and poet Leonardo Dati. On the 22nd of October of that year, Dati recited the Scena in the Cathedral of Florence in the famous poetry contest called the Certame Coronario. In this competition, entries had to be in the Vulgar, in Volgare, and the theme chosen was true friendship, de vera amicizia. Dati's Scena is in three parts, the third of which is spoken by Amicizia herself, and she describes six types of people among whom she unsuccessfully sought a welcome. The second of these types that she refers to is the rich, and very specifically she says, the rich che la fortuna ha rilevato ricchi, those whom fortune has raised to riches. So they don't deserve it. They've been raised there unexpectedly. Not those whose wealth entitles them to expressions of magnificence. When Amichitsio approaches these undeserving rich, she beats a hasty retreat because, as she says, ma il mio pensiero nichilato manca perché l'insulse e tumida azzitrice pompa ed insieme stomacoso lusso stavano dentro. And parts of this have been quite hard to translate, so I've had some help from Guido Ruggiero here, so this is partly his translation here. Friendship says, my thought defeated fails because foolish pomp, bursting with pride, together with revolting luxury, were there inside. So really vomitous, stomacoso lusso. So in this very first use of a vernacular word for luxury, lusso, it's twinned with a deeply derogatory adjective, stomacoso, sickening. So, you know, the Medici are not going to want to be found guilty of luxury at all. It's quite anachronistic to use this word for them. Dati's use then of his new word lusso is highly pejorative and is also inflected by Luxuria's medieval associations with these vices of lust and greed as well. So it's a neologism, but one that includes these older associations of lust. So this verse of Dati's is then, I argue, the critical moment in the creation of a new concept to describe the activities of a relatively new social group. In addition, the period's increased acquaintance with classical texts seems eventually to have brought about a re-envisioning of the Latin word luxuria itself. It's perhaps not surprising that just as the magnificent were carving out their own activities as something special and elite, that luxuria reappears as not just one of the seven deadly sins, but now the excess of magnificence and splendour, a state to be avoided. And the first use of luxuria in this sense that I've come across is by Leon Battista Alberti in his 10 books on architecture. He argues that it was preferable that the houses of the wealthy should be wanting in things that might contribute to their ornament, then have the more modest and thrifty accuse them of luxury in any way. So here again, it's not a good thing. Giovanni Pontano in De Splendore also uses this notion of luxury as the excess from a mean of magnificence. Pontano understood splendour as concerned with the ornament of the household, the care of the person and with furnishings, and in the display of different things. However, he warned, in this type of expenditure, one should always seek the mean, that which is measured, mediocritas. Certainly the just measure should be called splendour, its excess luxury, and its defect baseness. In all of these works, luxury is never a virtue, but rather a vice of excess. And the tendency to bring our modern understandings of the word luxury to the past has led to a simplification of contemporary understandings of this word. To tease out its meanings and associations for Italians of the Renaissance is to understand better the ambiguities and difficulties they experienced in participating in and creating, arguably, the Western world's first consumer society. I could give you many more examples of the ways in which luxury and the activities of the aping classes were denigrated in this period, and in particular with the ways in which the negative connotations of lust were twinned with the articulation of an ethic of greed seem to be characteristic of this class. But for the rest of my time, I want to concentrate on two Milanese treatises that I referred to earlier, which I think mark yet another key moment in the envisioning of luxury. Significantly, these two treatises were written in response to a sumptuary law. I say significantly because one of the most productive sources for analysing attitudes, at least at the governmental level, to the new consumptive practices of Italians is sumptuary law, which, as is well known, the Italians were particularly good at producing. Whilst it's often hard to get a sense of how sumptuary laws were received by the population, the history of this legislation in Italy is punctuated by intermittent appeals against the law, which give us a little window into broader attitudes. And these two Milanese treatises fall into this category of sumptuary law appeal. In 1898 and then in 1900, Ettore Verga wrote what still remain the classic two articles on sumptuary law in Milan. In the latter article, he refers to two anonymous treatises written in 1566 that challenged a sumptuary law passed in the previous year. No one, to my knowledge, has pursued this reference any further, and the treatises remain unexplored in the Archivio di Stato in Milan. What I'd like to do today is to tease apart the arguments presented in these treatises within this broader trajectory of arguments about and attitudes toward appropriate consumption in the period. What I hope will be clear is that these treatises mark a singular departure in the debate on luxury in the Italian and possibly European context. For the first time, an argument is made that luxury, so demonised, debated, ridiculed and parodied, is instead a moral good. And for the first time, an argument is made by merchants on behalf of merchants, but also on behalf of unemployed youth and the poor of a city. In addition, many years before the ideas of Adam Smith, an argument is made forcefully here for the continued freedom of the economy in Milan, as expressed through freedom of dress for all. Milan is unusual amongst Italian cities in that it passed very few sumptuary laws, and the ones it passed were quite half-hearted and not full of the usual minutiae that sumptuary laws from other cities provide in such depth and detail. The first statute that we know of from Milan is from 1396, and then there's not another one for a full century in 1498. Then over the next two centuries, Milan only passes a further six laws. And if you compare this to Florence, for example, which passed close to 30 laws in a similar time period, or Venice, which passes a similar number, there's something quite unusual about the Milanese context that I can't quite work out for the moment. On the 21st of November 1565, a sumptuary law was formulated in Milan, but by the foreign Spanish governor, by the Tribunale di Provisione, at the instigation of the Senate, after an order by the Spanish governor of the duchy. And I'm going to embarrass myself if anyone speaks Spanish here, but Gabriel de la Cueva y Girón, the fifth Duke of Albuquerque. The law this tribunal produced was unlike previous laws passed in the city. It was quite severe. It's full of detail and is really the first Milanese law that bears comparison with what had been passed over the previous two centuries elsewhere in the peninsula. This law is strictly hierarchical and gender-specific. There are laws for men, for women of noble birth, for borghesi, for courtiers, for peasants and foreigners. It covers what could be consumed at feasts, what rituals to follow at baptisms, funerals, as well as detailed provisions concerning clothing, all of the usual kinds of suspects of sumptuary law. Significantly for the protesters, this law also had strict prohibitions for clothing, which included any gold or silver on clothing or ornaments of the same, and in particular gold, crystal, silver, pearl, bejeweled or embroidered buttons, all products for which Milan was famous. Now, the following year, these two anonymous protests against the law appeared. This in itself is not new. Almost from their inception, we have indications in chronicles that sumptuary laws were protested against by their targets, and so therefore by women in particular. From the early 15th century, these gained momentum with petitions from women or from men on behalf of women, in particular against sumptuary laws that included excommunication as a penalty for their infraction. In 1437, for instance, the Venetian Cristina Corna wrote to the Pope asking that she be allowed exemption from a recent sumptuary law because of her noble blood, for the honour of her parents and because of her great beauty. She was granted the exemption. In 1453, the lengthiest protest against a sumptuary law was made by the Bolognese noblewoman and lover of Santa Bentivoglio, Nicolosa Sanuti. She produced a lengthy treatise against the sumptuary law of Cardinal Bessarion, who was the papal legate to Bologna. Amongst other arguments, she asserted that clothing was a mark of honour and that those who passed the law therefore placed love of money before love of the honour of the city and therefore were guilty of avarice. Most of all, she was incensed that a noble woman who had no other recourse than her garments to display her status and honour was now to be deprived of her clothing. And I quote, "Who would be so torpid or idle? What woman so unlearned? What female so pusillanimous that she would decline to speak in favour of the restoration, defence and preservation of her ornaments?" She, unfortunately, is not successful in getting the sumptuary law rescinded, despite the numerous lines that she writes about it. But these two Milanese protests mark a singular departure in this tradition of sumptuary law protest. For the first time, it is the merchants, the gold workers, the silk workers, the embroiderers of the city who were championed. And the arguments are broader on behalf of the health of the economy of the city as a whole, and not motivated by personal outrage at being personally deprived of fabulous clothing. The two appeals were not published and remain in manuscript in the Archivio di Stato. They're both written in the same hand, possibly therefore by a copyist, but their argumentative style is quite distinct, even if the content is shared to some great extent. So it does seem that they're penned by different authors, but there's a lot in the content that's similar, so they may have well discussed the content together. The first petition is 12 pages long and the second is 36. The first petition begins in the customary manner with praise of the justice of the ruling governor and his prudent care for the good of the state, not just for the public but also the private good. Then, the actions of your excellency in this state are well known in the world for being not only very just but also most prudent, and they proceed not only most judiciously but also circumspectly, always having regard to the public and private benefit. But, molto più particolarmente, having regard to the good of the merchants of this city and the infinite poor people dependent upon them. So this is very, very different to any other sumptuary law protest. These are not nobles pleading for the maintenance of long-held privileges, but the merchants of the city and merchants speaking on behalf of the poor of the city as well. Indeed, despite later references to more nuanced hierarchies in the city, for the first two pages of this petition, the writer divides the city quite simply into nobles, merchants and poveri. The second startling aspect of the petition is also made clear in the opening two pages. According to the writer, Milan, unlike the other cities of Italy, had always been free regarding clothing, and this is emphasised in both of the petitions, and had not been tightly regulated, and the writer clearly believes this to be a good thing. Not just from memory of present times, but also from the memory of the most ancient writers of this city, it has always been the case that there has been freedom of dress for everyone without distinction in the city. And this is something I find really curious, and it's emphasised again and again, and the fact that they only have two sumptuary laws, but it would make it alone really among Italian cities in not being regulated. To institute this law, he argues, would be most damaging for the populace of Milan, because now for the first time you will have divisions between people as their items of clothing are regulated according to station. Now you will pit nobles against knights, knights against merchants, merchants against plebeians, and you will cause without doubt the greatest contestations, discords, fights and seditions in this most tranquil and most quiet of cities, which would of course be the most displeasing occurrence for any virtuous and legitimate prince. Now, what is fascinating here also is that every other Italian city has made the opposite arguments in its sumptuary laws. In other words, that vestimentary codes are essential for order and stability, whereas here he's saying if you now put these vestimentary codes in, you'll have disorder in the city. Then the writer continues, this law would stop mercantile traffic in Milan to such an extent that it would be, if not extinguished, then certainly greatly diminished. From this it follows that the duties from trade, which are the nerve of the city's patrimony, and all the other duties relating to personal clothing would diminish even more greatly, because ceasing the commerce of the city would mean ceasing the commerce of foreigners, who in the greatest numbers bring to this city so much trade. From this follows the next reason. Nothing is dearer to a prince than to have his citizens rich and the city opulent. And it has been very useful in wars past for the conservation of the state of Milan to have the subjects so rich and the city so opulent that any needs that arise in time of war can be readily met. And there is no better means to maintain the opulence of the city than to maintain the crafts and the industries, the products of which people not only in the city but from places far away come to buy, such as cloth of silk and of gold. The ingenuity of the Milanese in conceiving of and creating the most beautiful work, not just suitable for mediocre persons, but also for princes, kings and emperors, means the state of Milan glories in having in her state industrious subjects. And here the writer inserts a little history lesson for the governor. It's for this reason that in the city of Milan, illustrious princes in the past and senators of old, considering how important and how useful it should be for the city of Milan to have these crafts, through public laws and statutes prohibited under the most severe penalties any artisan, especially those working in creating cloth of silk and gold, to go outside the city of Milan to teach their craft. If Milan had not instituted such laws, then those outside of the city would have learned how to do this long ago. If, however, this current law is carried out, then what are these workers to do except leave the city and teach others their skills and make other cities round about wealthier? This is the first time, again, as far as I know, that an argument has been made against sumptuary law on the basis of encouraging the industry of a city. Previously, it is sumptuary law provisions themselves that have maintained in their preambles that passage of the law would be to the benefit of the commerce of the city. A famous one, often quoted from Venice, for example, declares, "We want money to navigate and multiply, not lie dead, converted into vanities." Whereas here in this Milanese law, he's saying it's these vanities themselves which keep the industry going. Nicolozzo Sanuti argued that the ornaments of a city and the display of its wealth are a cause of honour. Here the writer continues, it's the industry of Milan itself which is honourable, and this again is the first time I've come across this. Every station of person in the city, by means of honest crafts, in gold as much as in silk, works in honest labours for the desire of earning a living. But removing freedom of dress in the city will mean the loss of any occasion to work and to exercise these crafts, and these people will be forced to abandon this country as they will have no other mode of life. With freedom of dress, however, the city flourishes and her mercantile industries become fat and opulent. The industry of Milan also has two other highly practical benefits for the city. The first is that it keeps youth off the streets and engaged in honest activity. And this, of course, also brings honour to the city and stops these youths from thinking of or doing bad things. The second benefit is one that seems obvious, but is a new argument, again, as far as sumptuary law protest is concerned. The industry of Milan, he argues, is not only of the greatest public and private benefit and a cause of growth for the city, but it gives a living to the infiniti poverelli, the infinite poor people who would otherwise be forced to disperse elsewhere. The second petition, though much longer, is similar in many respects. I'm not going to repeat the arguments it has in common with the first. But it's also interesting in the way in which it elaborates an ethic of consumption. It begins by invoking God in a way that is novel in arguments about greed and acquisition. First, he argues, God gave man the gift of ingenuity and industry, and you can therefore get a glimpse of the divine in the rich clothing made here on earth, and even perhaps in those who wear such clothing judiciously, he adds. Now, this is in stark contrast to the early church fathers who are often quoted, particularly Tertullian, who argued many centuries earlier that if God had meant men to wear coloured clothing, he would have created blue sheep. Secondly, he argues, you cannot pass a law that is only of benefit to a few, namely the gentiluomini, who are by this law given the greatest freedom in clothing. Echoing the other petition, this writer says that it's a well-known fact that there has always been liberty of dress for all in Milan, and that this has led to the city becoming wealthier than any other city in Italy. The real cause of problems in the city arises not from giving people freedom of dress, but from the vice of ambition. And given that ambition is an act of the will against which no law can do anything, you cannot argue, he writes, that this same ambition would go away just because we now have laws restricting clothing. Moreover, if you restrict the possibilities for people to buy clothing with their money, then you run the risk that they may use their money for other more sinful purposes. Because of the diligence of the Milanese workers, this country has made a marvellous metamorphosis from the sterile place that nature made into a very fertile man-made place, which has not just doubled but tripled the value of the lands to the great benefit of the gentiluomini, of the merchants, of the workers and the whole city. And for this reason, the city's forefathers had not just given freedom to the craftsmen of the city, but also privileges to encourage them to stay in the city and not share their secrets. From all of these great trades in the city, the workers earn not only their own maintenance, but also that of those dependent upon them, fathers, mothers, wives, spouses, and their children. Also, he says, the infinite number of nuns who in their monasteries also practice these crafts. Indeed, he goes so far as to say that a third of the mouths of the city are maintained due to the arts of gold and silk. This writer also directly addresses the issue of vestimentary codes and places it once again within a moral framework. Should one say that it is decorous for a city to be able, through clothing, to discern at first sight ignobles from the nobles, one could reply that this is worthless, and that if instead one could take away ambition, one would have no need for such distinctions. Men should be able to tell virtuous qualities in each other not through clothing but through acts of virtue, It diminishes the honour of a city if it requires clothing in order to tell whether its citizens are virtuous or not. Liberty of dress is good because it animates in the souls of men a desire to strive towards industry, which, as has been said, is il fundamento et l'anima di questa città. It's also good because young people occupying themselves in thoughts of how to dress have less time to think of adultery or homicides and betrayals and other excesses. When the people are faithful and loving, as are those of the city of Milan, a prince knows that to conserve such a loving people is not through innovations that disrupt the peace of the citizens, and above all that of the freedom and largesse of the shops. This provision would impoverish the universal purse of this city, would extinguish the traffic of the crafts of gold and silk and their dependencies, and would thereby extinguish the great and honourable manner with which the money of this city has multiplied. And therefore all those aforementioned would leave Milan, taking as much money with them as they could. To mess with the industry of this city would cause its downfall. These two petitions express a whole new paradigm regarding consumption in Italy that has clearly been gaining momentum over the previous century. Here, consumption is not merely a practice that should be reserved for elites, but a widespread universal practice with implications for everyone, from the poorest in the city up to the highest levels. And this consumption and all those involved in its production in and of itself is an honourable thing. Expenditure, ornamentation and excess were vital topics of discussion for Italians who, within a burgeoning economic and social milieu, attempted to formulate the appropriate legal, economic, social, ecclesiastical, moral, theological and artistic attitudes to adopt towards these topics. Consumption was, and of course still is, not just a social, economic and symbolic practice, but also a locus of political conflict and engagement and of intense moral debate. Thank you.